Welcome, everyone. Beautiful day out there. I'm late because I took a spin around the mall here. Okay, you have your script, Roger.
Can we do that for today's meeting?
We could just put everyone on the microphones and
do it outside.
Everybody cool with that? We all move outside? Motion passed unanimously. Okay, Senator, I'm going to open a work session for possible reconsideration of House Bill 2252. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2252.
Senator Beyer has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2252. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Okay. The rules have been suspended. Okay. Now, Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2252.
Senator Beyer has moved that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2252 was passed out of committee as amended and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Okay, the motion has carried and the vote has been reconsidered.
Madam Chair, now do you want to send the bill directly to the floor?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, I move we send House Bill 2252 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And that the
subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Senator Beyer has moved that House Bill 2252 be referred to the Senate floor with a due pass recommended as amended with the dash three amendments. And that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Thank you. Cool.
Good deal. Thank you, Carrie.
Do we have Walker?
Yeah.
We'll stick with our horse here. We'll have Senator Walker carry this committee. We don't make very many mistakes around here. That's why it was difficult for us to fix this one. Okay. Actually, it wasn't actually a mistake.
It's not a mistake.
It was a reconsideration, yes. Okay. All right. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2366. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2366 tolls the statute of limitations for an action brought by a parent for recovery of a child's medical expenses if the limitations period for the child's lawsuit is also tolled and the child's and parent's actions arise out of the same conduct. And tolling means pausing the statute of limitations.
Means what?
To pause the statute of limitations. So it stops the running of the statute of limitations.
So this would only be only in what circumstances?
So right now, under ORS 12.160, the running of the statute of limitations for a child is tolled in certain circumstances. And the statute says that the limitations cannot be extended for more than 5 years or 1 year beyond a child's 18th birthday, whichever is earlier. But the statute does not toll the action of a parent, even if it arises out of the same conduct. So what this bill would do is say if the child's statute of limitations is tolled by virtue of ORS 12.160, then the parents would also be tolled for the same period, so they could bring the lawsuit at the same time.
Okay, why don't we get our witness up here, Mustafa Kasubai? I didn't murder your name too much here.
Verdict, members of the committee, my name is Mustafa Kasubai. I am a member of the Oregon State Bar Procedures and Practices Committee, and the committee identified a cleanup situation in this legislation to allow the consolidation of the parents' claim. Let me back up, if I might. There are times in which a minor who's injured in an automobile accident has medical bills paid by their parents. What happens is that provides a separate cause of action, potentially, for the parents who've paid medical bills against the defendant to seek those medical bills. But because a minor who's injured is not required to file a lawsuit during the time that they're a minor, for certain exceptions. But the parent's cause of action for those medical expenses starts to run. You might end up being required, the parent that is, to file a separate lawsuit before the child even pursues their lawsuit. What happens is that you end up creating two separate lawsuits in order to ensure that the parent's medical, the payments of those medical expenses get paid back by the defendant. What this tolling change does is allows the tolling to occur for both the parent and the minor, so that way we eliminate excess lawsuits, consolidating the claim for both the parents for those medical expenses and the child's claim for other damages together.
And I assume your group that considered this for the bar included both plaintiff's bar and defense bar?
Yes. The Procedures and Practices Committee is comprised of 17 members. One, myself, who is a member of the Oregon Workers' Compensation Board, and by virtue of my work, I'm an impartial decision maker, although I should clarify that I'm here today as a member of the Procedures and Practices Committee. We also have 16 members from the civil practice arena, both from the plaintiffs and defense bars.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Yeah.
Senator Pisanski.
One question, and that's, does the statute automatically toll in the sense of that the parent would be prohibited from bringing the suit earlier than when the child would bring their suit?
I don't believe it automatically tolls, Senator Chair Burdick, Senator Pisanski.
Thanks.
But they would have that option to wait until, so that they could have a consolidated suit. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, that would be correct.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I'm just curious, this section, or section 1, sub 3, what it's talking about when the person is insane or, I suppose, is incapable of knowing what they're doing. Based on this, that extends the statute theoretically forever.
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, the original language of this legislation allowed the tolling of the statute for both what they considered disabilities, being both a minor and insane. What this does, when you read Section 3 and 4 together, it provides for that same maximum cap of the 5 years.
Okay.
As well for people that are deemed to be insane under this statute and other legal principles.
Okay. Any other questions? Did you have something else to add?
Chair Burdick, no.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2366 and open a work session on House Bill 2366. Senator Barnes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2366 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2366 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Is there anybody who'd like to carry this? I'll carry it then. Okay. Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2385A. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2385A requires self-insurers to provide liability coverage to permissive drivers of their vehicles. The bill establishes that such coverage is secondary to any coverage available to a customer of the self-insurer, an operator of the self-insured vehicle, or an occupant of the self-insured vehicle. The bill also establishes that a self-insurer is not required to insure a person who operates a vehicle without permission of the self-insurer. It permits a self-insurer to recover from the permissive driver any money paid by the self-insurer to the injured party, and it allows injured parties to collect from their own uninsured or underinsured coverage if the amount they recover from the self-insured is less than the uninsured liability limit.
Okay, we have a panel, Joel DeVore, Neil Jackson, and Steve Morrell. And Sam Sears. You didn't put the bracket around your name, Sam.
Sorry.
So now you're the only one, okay.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I will be brief, and the panel, as you described, will come up and talk about the details of this bill. I just want to introduce it as a law commission bill.
Can you introduce yourself first?
Sorry, yes, again. Sam Sears with the Oregon Law Commission. So, again, 2385, as staff counsel explained, fixes a gap in insurance law that currently exists. This bill went through the law commission process and was agreed upon by all the stakeholders. You have three documents coming to you. Those documents are the report, and that the law commission, with all of its bills, of course, has a report that's probably more comprehensive than you would need or want. But if you desire, you can read all about this bill and the process in that report. There's also a one-page summary that you would probably find pretty helpful, going through just some of the basics of the bill in shorter fashion. And then there's also a memorandum that has some different questions that came up over the House side, and then how those would be answered under the bill. So again, Steve Merrill from State Farm Insurance is here, and Neil Jackson from Neil Jackson and Partners, and Joel DeVore from Louvis Cobb here, and they can speak about some of the details of this bill.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Sears? Senator Cruz?
Well, so basically this means if I went to Hertz to rent a car and they offered me insurance, I wouldn't need to buy it because they're going to be required to cover me, correct?
I will let the experts answer those questions and any others that you may have.
But it's a good question. We'll just wait to answer it. Senator Pazanski?
I was going to just say something to Senator Cruz. I think your own insurance is probably going to cover you.
I understand that, but
so you're gonna
this is permissive driver would be somebody who runs from Hertz.
All right.
And they always try to hook you for insurance, and now I won't have to buy it.
Well, you never did before, Senator Cruz.
Well, I never did before.
Unless you hooked yourself.
Buy it one way or the other.
Okay, on that note, we will invite our panel up. If you'd all please introduce yourself before you start talking. Thank you.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I am Joel DeVore, a member of the Auto Insurance Work Group with the Oregon Law Commission, and I'll let the other gentlemen introduce themselves.
My name is Neil Jackson, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
On behalf of who?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear you.
I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney with State Farm Insurance. I'm here as one of the members of the auto subgroup that worked on the Oregon Law Commission bill you see in front of you.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, if I can explain briefly, Oregon's scheme of auto insurance has two holes or two failures in your policy and everyone's policy. They both relate in different ways to what we call self-insured cars. And let me explain in a moment what a self-insured car, but the problem is basically if you leave the session today, there is a chance that if you are hit and injured by the negligence of the, let's use a rental car as an example of a self-insured car, there's a chance that you won't get any liability coverage as a result of that accident. And there is a certainty that you won't get your own uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage due to the holes in Oregon's auto insurance scheme. So this bill, 2385, has two fixes, one for each of the problems. Now, a self-insured car is, in Oregon, well, let me back up one more step. In Oregon, we have the financial responsibility law, which we all know of, which requires that every driver and every car owner have auto liability insurance. And one feature of that is it requires that the auto policy must cover permissive drivers, people who drive with the permission of the owner. That's to be sure that everybody has liability coverage. The problem develops when Oregon statute allows people who have fleets of 25 cars or more, typically like car dealers, utilities, governments, or car rental agencies, to self-insure, to say, look, we promise to pay the same amounts as we would pay if we bought commercial insurance from Steve Merrill's State Farm. That is good as far as it goes, but the problem is there was a court case that happened to construe the same amounts in a narrow way to mean only the dollar figures, but not necessarily the who or the when. And so the problem developed that a self-insured car did not have to cover people that drive with permission of the owner, unlike a commercial auto policy that you might have from State Farm or whoever your company is. Now, that's okay if the person who goes up to the car dealer counter, you know, it has their own coverage, and usually they do. But sometimes either they don't know that their coverage got canceled, who knows, it's a divorce case and the spouse canceled their coverage, the coverage lapsed or there's an exclusion. But it happens infrequently. That's why I said there's a chance there may not be liability coverage. Well, ordinarily, if the driver didn't have their own personal policy, Oregon's financial responsibility law would say, well, the car owner is supposed to have coverage for permissive users. But unfortunately, not so for self-insured cars, and that's the whole. So what happens is if you're injured by the negligence of a driver of a, let's say, a rental car, to keep it our example clear, you may not recover any liability insurance. This bill would repair that hole in the coverage simply by requiring that if the driver didn't have their own personal policy, that as a fallback measure, the owner of the self-insured car would provide the basic, not more, but the basic $25,000, $50,000 coverage that the financial responsibility law requires. So it's simply making sure that, that when you self-insure, you do indeed make the same promise to cover as a commercial insurer would. Now, the problem, the second hole in the coverage is more devious and perhaps more devastating. Whether or not, well, the problem is this. If the self-insured car that injured you leaves you with no insurance, you would turn to your own State Farm or other good company. But the problem is our Oregon statute assumed in the old days that if it was a self-insured car, it'd be paying money. No one ever thought of this potential that it wouldn't pay money. So your policy and mine and everyone else's says if you're injured by a self-insured car, you don't get your own uninsured coverage. Because by definition, a self-insured car, an uninsured car can't be a self-insured car. But in truth, you may not get paid. So this bill would fix that problem simply by saying if you're not paid by the self-insured car, your uninsured motorist coverage will still kick in like you expect. The problem is even a step worse. You may have purchased something like $100,000 or $500,000 of what's called underinsured motorist coverage. The problem that exists in today's law without this bill is if the driver of the self-insured car, the rental car, has their coverage and they pay $25,000, or you've got a good company like Enterprise that's going to probably step up and pay for as the owner of the car anyway, you may get $25,000, but you're going to turn and you're going to want your uninsured motorist coverage that you paid for, your $100,000, your $500,000, for the rest of your medical bills or for whatever. And you'll discover that for the very same reason, because a self-insured car is defined as not an uninsured, it's also defined as not an underinsured, and you can't get your own underinsured coverage that you have paid for and thought you always had. So the second fix not only fixes the problem with the risk that perhaps the self-insured car won't pay and will be uninsured in reality, but it also fixes the problem that even if you do get the minimum 25, as the law stands, you don't get your UIM or underinsured. This will fix that, and you'll get the coverage that you assume that you have.
Okay. I actually understood that. Committee, any questions? Welcome.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. Again, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I was also a member of the work study group for the Oregon Law Commission. Joe did such a good job explaining what the bill does that I don't think that I really need to add anything. I will simply add that this hole's been around for a while and it really needs to be fixed, because the instances where I've handled cases where there's been an uninsured person driving a rental car and it was a mess for 4 years trying to figure out how to make stuff happen so that the injured people got what they deserved to get. It was just a mess, and this bill would have solved that problem.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, once again, Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance Companies. I think Joel did a good job explaining it. I just want to be able to be available to answer any questions the committee may have. I really don't have anything further to add.
Any questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Thank you for bringing us this bill. This sounds like a very nice bill. Close public hearing on House Bill 2385A and open a work session on House Bill 2385A. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2385A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2385A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry this? Senator Pazansky. Okay. Now. Let's see. 24, 23. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2423. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2423A, reorganized statutes relating to notices of agency action in contested cases. The bill establishes that agencies must, in a contested case, send parties written notice of the rights and procedures that apply to the case. It also clarifies that an officer at a hearing must develop the record fully to include the facts and the law applicable to the issues before the tribunal.
I don't know why. Okay, thank you. Karen Berkowitz from the Oregon Law Center. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Karen Berkowitz from the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2423. This bill arose out of some of our practitioners' general confusion about the organization of the notice and contested case hearing statutes in the Administrative Procedures Act. There are two kinds of agency notices. One is the notice that describes the agency action, and the other is a notice of hearing, and the statutes confused the two kinds of notices. And one of the notice statutes also concern information about what happens at the hearing and hearing procedures. So what this bill does is it separates out the two types of notices and creates a separate statute that describes what the hearing procedure is going to be at a contested case hearing. There are some substantive changes. I think my written testimony summarizes them, so I'll just go over a couple. There was no requirement before that the notice of hearing be in writing, and this clarifies that the notice has to be in writing. The notice of hearing never required that the parties be informed about whether discovery is permitted. It doesn't change the substantive law about whether a certain agency has to provide discovery or not. It just tells the person that will be going through the hearing whether they can request discovery and how to do that. It describes the hearing procedure. It generally identifies the issues to be considered at the hearing, and I just want to clarify that this is really intended to allow agencies to use some standard notice of hearing forms if the hearing's issues are always the same. It does not take away the obligation to give a proper notice about what the issues are at the hearing. And just to clarify, it is not intended to change the rule of law established in the case of Villanueva v. Board of Psychiatric Examiners, which does require adequate notice of the issues to be given to anybody who's a party to a contested case hearing. Do you have any questions for me?
Any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Barr.
In the change number two, you mentioned the discovery. I see in your written testimony it says the provision does not change whether or not discovery is allowed or not, but how are agencies, and I mean, how is it decided if the discovery is going to be allowable or not?
That's up to the agency's own rule. Each agency has different provisions about discovery. There are general provisions that are in the Model Attorney General's rules as well. All this does is it says that the agency has to tell you what their rules are, basically, whether you have discovery or don't have discovery, and how you go about requesting it. But it doesn't change the whether there is or is not a right to discovery.
Any other follow-up, Senator Barr? Please.
You want me to ask another question, I take it.
I count on you on bills like this, Senator Barr.
Well, Madam Chair, I was, were you going to go through the rest of the bill, or were you done?
If there's anything I can go through the other provisions, certainly. It clarifies that the parties can introduce evidence and respond to issues that are properly before the presiding officer. I think that's to clarify that in situations where you have to file an answer and put particular matters at issue, the evidence and the procedure at the hearing is limited to whatever is specifically at issue. You can't bring in anything extraneous. The notice of agency action also provides that it will inform the parties under what circumstances a default order can be entered, whether it's by not requesting a hearing or by not appearing at a hearing, just so people know the consequences of, okay, I've got this notice from the agency, what happens if I don't do anything, and what happens if I request a hearing and then change my mind. The notice also describes how to request a hearing, or in the alternative, that automatically schedule a hearing at the same time of the notice, they still have the right to just automatically schedule a hearing. Again, different agencies work different ways. Some require the party to request a hearing, and some just set it automatically. Then the default order can only be issued based on a prima facie case on the record, including materials submitted by the parties. The statute, as currently written, just talks about the agency's record, and we wanted to clarify that if a party submits information to the agency or requests a hearing and submits information to the presiding officer, and then there's a subsequent default, that information will be part of the record on default. The presiding officer must develop a record that shows a full and fair inquiry into the facts necessary for consideration of the issues and the correct application of the law to the facts. The intent of this was to ensure that the Berwick case is still good law, and there's been some question about, after the creation of the Independent Office of Administrative Hearings, whether the same duty exists for the presiding officer to develop a full record of the facts and the law, and this emphasizes that, yes, there is that same duty. Are there any questions for me?
This is a very technical bill, shall we say. Does the Department of Justice have a position in favor of this bill?
We worked with them on it, and we had amendments on the House side, and they were worked out with the Department of Justice. So this reflects our agreement. And
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I guess the obvious question for me is why now, and what's the problem you're trying to fix?
The problem, I guess, Chair Burdick, Representative Beyer, the problem was that there were many matters that we hoped that agencies addressed and followed in terms of practice, but they weren't required in the law, including discovery. And discovery was a problem. I mean, people, especially pro ses, don't know what their rights are, what they can do. They assume, you know, oh, you get this notice and you go to a hearing and that's it. And, you know, it's a question of educating people. No, you can request documents, you can get information from the other side and prepare for the hearing. A lot of our concern, frankly, is with low-income pro se individuals getting complete information up front, both in the notice of agency action, the notice of hearing, and, you know, having a complete description of what's going to happen, because really many people who participate in contested case hearings are unrepresented.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pruszynski.
So it sounds like what the Commission is attempting to do is have some type of uniformity through all the agencies, with everyone being required, where maybe they weren't doing it on their own voluntarily, to give information out to those who are going to be coming before that agency, so at least those individuals know what to expect, what their rights could be, and whether they want to exercise them or not. Is that kind of a thumbnail of it?
Yeah, Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszynski, yes, I think that's a good summary of what is really being accomplished by this bill.
Okay, thank you. And I want to offer a special thanks to the questions from my committee members on this one. All right, any other questions? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2423 and open the work session on House Bill 2423. Senator Breyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2423 engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Breyer has moved House Bill 2423 engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I'd like to put something on the record if I could.
Yes, please.
I think this is a great bill because we all have constituents that I assume we all get those calls that I've been in front of some board or some agencies taking some action against me. What are my rights? Or I didn't realize that they could do this or could do that, whatever it may be. And I know that I've had some situations where people have gone through the full process and then they've actually gotten a ruling from the administrative law judge in their favor, only to have the agency be able to override that decision. And this, of course, is not going to address that issue, but at least this is, a first step of making certain that before one of our constituents finds himself in front of an agency on an administrative law proceeding, that they're going to know exactly what they're walking into, what their rights are, how they can get discovery from these agencies, and making certain that there's some, let's call it, fairness and accountability before the person is actually before the tribunal.
Thank you, Senator Prezanthi. Thanks for getting that on the record. Is there any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Prezanski, would you like to carry this?
I'll do that.
Unless Senator Breyer wants to. All right. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2906. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. ORS 659.850 prohibits discrimination in public education. It provides that no person in Oregon, quote, shall be subjected to discrimination in any public elementary, secondary, or community college education program or service school or interschool activity or in any higher education program or service school or interschool activity where the program, service, school, or activity is financed in whole or in part by monies appropriated by the Legislative Assembly. ORS 659.860, however, only allows actions in civil court if the person claims to be aggrieved by unlawful discrimination in higher education. House Bill 2906 would establish that a person claiming to be aggrieved by unlawful discrimination in public education, not simply higher education, may bring a discrimination action in circuit court.
Okay, thank you. And I presume that if that person were a minor, which they would always be in this case, that would be brought on their behalf by their parents?
I believe that is correct.
Okay, what maybe
Madam Chair,
more details?
Why would a person be discriminated against if he always be a minor?
Because if it's not higher education, if it's not always, but it's my interpretation, it's designed for kids in primary and secondary education.
But you could have some that's emancipated that's in
correct.
That situation. I think that's maybe what Senator Barr is saying.
So I probably overstated, but we'll get the full scoop here from Ms. Meyer.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, and I confess this is the first time in my history of lobbying for the ACLU that we bring forward to you a bill on behalf of the ACLU, and you can see how controversial it is. This fixes a procedural problem in appeals to school discrimination cases. It does not make any other changes to the law. It does not give any new rights. It streamlines the process and aligns it with higher education. There's no opposition to this bill. I worked with all the stakeholders, the school folks, Department of Justice, Superintendent of Public Instructions, and they are all neutral. Indeed, in committee, although Representative Cameron and Representative Flores voted no originally in the committee simply because, as they put on the record at the time, they had some questions they wanted to clarify, they both supported the bill on the floor. Representative Flores spoke in favor of the bill, recognizing the unique situation she was to support an ACLU bill. Representative Krieger, indeed, floor-stamped our memo. This is truly a bipartisan issue, and I hope it continues that way. I'm going to skip to something I'm sure Representative Beyer will ask me, which is why now, why here? And the answer to that, Senator Beyer, I apologize. The answer to that is that we've issue spotted this as a problem for a long time. And this was part of a bigger work group that the Department of Justice and other stakeholders in dealing with the Administrative Procedures Act met with for a number of years. Indeed, there was legislation brought forward by DOJ in past years. And because we needed this fixed, and the legislation didn't quite do that, it didn't move forward. So this is the other approach. That doesn't need to be part of the bigger APA fix. Let's pull this bill out, this law out, and I'll explain why it should be out of that process. As counsel indicated, this is part of the discrimination law in schools that we've had on the books. In 1985, it was amended to permit higher education chains to go to circuit court. And for some reason that I don't know why, the same opportunity was not given for K through 12. And the result is it just greatly increases the cost to all parties and takes years longer to litigate. And let me explain why. So the process for everyone in all kinds of discrimination claims, and we certainly support, is complain to the school. And that's still required. See if you can informally address the problem. It does make sense. It gives the chance for the school to resolve. However, under 659-860, the claims go directly to the circuit court for higher education if they don't resolve it within that process. But instead, for K through 12, you have to go to the superintendent of public instructions. And what happens there is now you are sucked into the world of the Administrative Procedures Act. No other discrimination law in our books does that. And in past experience and in consultation with experts in this area of the whole world of discrimination law, it doesn't make sense because an agency isn't the right place to adjudicate discrimination. They have no expertise, and as I said, it makes it unnecessarily complicated and lengthy because you still can go to circuit court. You've just had to go through this whole process. Now, the problem is that the superintendent does not give you a hearing and you appeal to the circuit court, it becomes a review of an other than contested case. And it makes it procedurally complicated, ties the hands of the judges, and there's a lot more hoops in terms of review to go on rather than getting to was there discrimination here or not. So the court's restricted in its view, and when you appeal it to the circuit court, the superintendent of public instructions becomes a defendant in the case. And then if the court says, well, there should have been a hearing before the superintendent and remands it back, now you have the superintendent who had become a defendant in a case, the judge again, which just sets up a bad dynamic for all involved, and it makes no sense. They really are no longer a neutral adjudicator. The end result is years of litigation, and it's costly, and it's particularly costly to school districts. When ACLU ever brings any cases, there's a few factors. I mean, one, our attorneys do not charge. Two, we try not to seek costs and damages in our cases. Usually our clients just want relief. And so we're not looking for money. We're looking for the change. So we believe this change, though, in the law, benefits everyone. It removes an inappropriate administrative appeal process, and it resolves what have been really few and far between claims and allows them to go quickly. So we think that after you bring your case to the school, and if you don't get resolution, get it before a neutral judge. If you have a claim, get it resolved. If you don't, you, the family, move forward. You're done. So with that, I would urge a passage of this bill, and would, of course, be happy to answer any questions.
Was there any policy reason for making higher ed different in this regard, or was it just an oversight?
Chair Burdick, it was back in 1985, and I was not able to locate the discussion. If I looked at the whole law, I mean, it's been a little bit piecemeal. So I don't know why. But at this point, I think based on, you know, the school's experience with the law on the books, they have no problem streamlining this consistent with the higher education.
And does the superintendent of public instruction support this?
She is neutral. DOJ is neutral. School folks are neutral. No one has concerns that this is a problem and that this change should give anyone concerns.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you. I'm just trying to think, I mean, the reason higher ed was brought in and not anybody else originally. And If it goes in the Administrative Procedure Act underneath the Department of Education, is there a versus the circuit court, is it possible that the minors would be able to be kept more anonymous, I guess, versus a public court action?
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, I want to answer a few things there. One of the flaws of looking at this bill is you only see one section of the school discrimination law, so the rest of the underlying school discrimination includes K through 12. So this is when we talk about only higher education, it was just that particular appeal process. There is no anonymity in administrative procedures. We have an open court, and that includes administrative procedures. Any parent and child who is bringing a case is going before the school board. The process, in most schools, they've set up a process. So you must grieve maybe to the teacher, to the principal, and then to the next layer, depending on how big the school district is, eventually to the principal, and you can take it to the school board, and that's an open public process. So no, with all due respect, there's no reason to ever think that it was limited to, or went to the superintendent first as a protection, because the current law allows you then to appeal that decision to circuit court. If you have a contest, and you heard a bit before, and I love the APA, I only know it well because of this law, to know it is to not love it, but when you go to the APA, you either get a contested case proceeding and you get some discovery, or you get an other than contested case proceeding, and then you either go to circuit court or court of appeals. So no matter how these cases came out and how the superintendent or the school did it eventually, it would go to some level of our circuit court, court of appeals, and Supreme Court. And so I think they're already really public in the school system, and so there's no anonymity. It's trying to remedy. I think that were a dynamic in a case where they wanted to be for reasons of protection, and we've seen that in other parts of the country where in a town the parent and the minor feel some need for protection because of bringing forward an issue that they're is controversial, that they can seek protection through the court with the name. And I assume there's a process here, but I'm not familiar with any need for that in these kind of cases or that it's arisen.
Would this result in less cost for school districts that find themselves on the wrong end of these suits?
Chair Burdick, I think absolutely, because what this can do is you spend more time in litigation before the superintendent where you can still go to circuit court. And as I've said, the circuit court's hands are tied and might be sending it back to the superintendent, and you have an up and down, as you all are becoming more and more familiar with. The court's that up and down can take 1 or 2 or 3 years,
but
and then it can
that,
be appealed.
How does that impose costs on the school district?
Well, the school district is defending these and challenging the procedural as well as the substantive issues throughout, and if the DOJ gets involved, they might be litigating other related issues about the procedural process of this case for other reasons. So instead, this streamlines it. You try to resolve it within the school, and the school attorneys might get involved at that time. If you don't, you file it in circuit court. You have control by a judge in terms of the scope of discovery, and then it proceeds either up to the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, or not, or gets resolved and no one appeals. That still does happen in these cases. It just removes the superintendent period and time involved in that, and the procedural APA process that this gets ensnared into.
Okay.
And I see Senator Byer is looking up the law, so.
Thank you. Senator Byer, are you finding anything there?
Just
659-850 is, I believe, the underlying law, and then 860 is the appeals process that's been somehow designated for higher education. So that's why you look at the bill and you see it's removing higher education, because it's just adding 850 as a whole, which is K through 12 in higher education.
Do you need a moment, Senator Byer? I'm waiting for you. If you take 30 more seconds, you're going to have to carry the bill.
Well,
you're asking me to vote no, then, aren't you?
No, not at all.
Yeah, I agree. This, the way this is written, it does take it sort of out of context, and it would $9,850, it lays out the discrimination process, and I don't have the rest of the statutes in front of me to. Oh, I do. I think. I do.
Well, it helps if you're in 659, 659A.
Oh, 650. Yeah, not a. Yeah,
yeah, I was in 659A. That's all.
Okay. Okay. They actually, well, they've changed this law. It used to be 659-150, so go figure. And I actually have a copy of the relevant sections, but if you've got them in front of you, I'm sorry, I should have handed that to you all so you could see the context.
You want to hand this?
No, I've got there now. I said I just didn't want to chat with you.
Are you okay to proceed, or do you need some more?
No,
okay.
I'm fine.
Okie dokie. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, close the hearing on House Bill 2906. Open a work session on House Bill 2906. Hereby, you want to make a motion, or you want someone else to?
Madam Chair, move House Bill 2906 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2906 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this. That completes our agenda. We need to all go for a walk. Uh-huh. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
We should have just made that part of the requirement.